podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Alex Kalanorkas, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Welcome to the second episode in our mini-series running over the 2022 Formula One Summer Break, another series of debates over the greatest drivers at various Grand Prix squads. And this time, it's Brabham. But before we dive into the top 10 ranking on this episode, I'm coming first to the person who has put it together, Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner. Now, Kev, you were assessing in our previous episode, Jake Boxall-Legg's top 10 Arrows drivers. How did you find that? Are you happy to be back in your typical role as Autosport's principal list writer?
Yeah, it was quite nice being on the other side of the debate, if you like, to try and not attack, but analyse someone else's list. But I'll be honest, I probably feel more comfortable having done the research to put the list together, because you're just a bit that much more into it if you're actually there and know you've got to make the list and then defend it. So I'm kind of pleased. But then I suppose it depends how the next 45 minutes or an hour or whatever it is goes, and we'll see if my guest has torn my list to shreds by the end.
Indeed, and on that note, we better introduce our second guest, which is a welcome back to the Autosport Podcast for our former editor-in-chief, experienced motorsport journalist, Damien Smith. How are you, Damo?
Very well, thanks, Alex. Nice to be here. Nice to see you both.
What is the difference? And I suspect maybe Kev, you'd be able to give us an answer on this. What is the difference between a chief editor and an editor in chief?
I mean, there is ostensibly none. When we were coming up with my job title, those were the two options. And having spoken to Damien before about some of the trials and tribulations he'd had with that role, I was like, well, I'll have the other one then. So it literally is as arbitrary as that.
Poison chalice editor in chief, that's what I would say. So yeah, chief editor is better.
I was going to say that quite that harsh, but yeah, so that explains it. It's been all right so far, touchwood. I mean, unless you count, you know, pandemic and the mag closure and beer opening again. And yeah, actually, that's perhaps
pretty small things.
Yeah, pretty minor. Yeah.
But I don't think any of those were your fault.
I should always blame
the guy in charge. It's always his fault.
Right, well, quickly before we get into Kev's Brabham list, here's a reminder for the listeners of how we arrange these episodes. For each entry, I'll introduce the driver in question and summarise their Brabham career. Then, Kev, you're going to explain why that driver is in that slot, although, as for a couple, we'll talk about the drivers together in little groupings to explain their positions as it comes up nice and naturally. And then for each discussion, Damo, you're going to be assessing Kev's reasoning and logic, if indeed there is any, although we should hope so. And as we go through, we'll also cover off the drivers who didn't quite make the cut. So, number 10 in the top 10 Brabham drivers is Carlos Pache. Drove for Brabham between 1974 and 1977, started 39 races, took one win and one pole. So Kev, why is he at number 10?
Well, we talked about unfulfilled potential and talent in the previous list, and I think this is the equivalent on the Brabham list. Pache was an up-and-coming talent, if you like, joined alongside, effectively, the number two to Carlos Reutemann in 1974. And he took a pole and wins, as you say, won his home race in 1975 in the very cool BT44B. I think that's cool. And I've won Gordon Murray's great F1 designs. And actually, he felt that he could have gone on challenge for the championship had they continued developing it. And the reason he's on this list really is his kind of attitude within the team. So when Brabham switched from the Cosworth DFV engine to Alfa Romeo's, Reutemann kind of lost interest and didn't really like it. The first car in 76 was not great. It had quite a few reliability problems, but Pache kept the attitude, kept pushing on, and really, you know, started to look like he could be a, you know, consistent front runner. Finished second in the Argentinian Grand Prix in the 45B early in 77, but was then unfortunately killed in a light aircraft crash that March. Now, given what John Watson went on to do, yeah, he should have won races in that correlation year. And you think, yeah, Parche would have probably been in a similar place, maybe a little bit better. But for me, the sort of clincher that gets him onto the list is Ecclestone's quote, where he said, if Parche had lived, I wouldn't have needed Niki Lauda. And obviously, Niki Lauda's one of the great names of the sport. So for Ecclestone to say that, I think, is quite a big deal.
Well, Damo, coming to you, do you agree with that? And maybe are there any suggestions who could have come in at number 10 instead of Parche?
Well, I think Parche is the right one for number 10. I'll come on to later in the list about who I think should be in the list, who isn't. But number 10 for Parche, I agreed with. It's also interesting that he, as a character, was really close to Bernie. So he's one of the few drivers that Bernie was close to in the way that Stuart Lewis Evans was in the 50s, obviously, and then Jochen Rindt, both killed in racing cars or via after accidents. And Parche was another one, killed in a light aircraft accident. I don't think Bernie ever got as close to drivers as he did after Parche. Even Piquet, I would say, he wasn't as close to. So they had a real affinity. They used to play a lot of cards together, apparently. Yeah, I think he would have been a multiple race winner had he lived.
Well, moving on to number 9, Kev's got John Watson. Drove for Brabham in two stints, 1973 to 1974 and 1977 to 1978. Started 15 races, didn't take any wins, but did get one pole position. So Kev, why is Watson at number 9?
I guess two main reasons, really. One is that he kind of picked up and led the team after Parche's death in 77. As I say, really should have won the French Grand Prix. Been fortunate enough to and a couple of others he could have won, but the French Grand Prix is the one that really stands out. I spoke to him about that. You know, he was holding off Mario Andretti's Lotus, and he was pretty confident that he had him covered. And then there was a sort of fuel starvation issue on the very last lap, which was enough for Mario to get alongside and beat him. And he had a very similar... I don't think they ever really got to the bottom of that problem. And had the same thing happening when he was battling for the lead at the British Grand Prix as well. So he should have probably won a couple of races there. And then actually, he compared pretty well to Lauda. I know that Lauda famously said that, oh, he always felt like he had John Watson covered. It was only when Prost arrived at McLaren that he was worried. But actually, even at McLaren, Watty outscored him for two seasons. And he compared pretty well alongside Lauda at Brabham. So I think, you know, with that sort of company and what he'd done in 77 was enough to get him on the list, even though he didn't actually have a win that I think he deserved.
Yeah, Watty's incredibly honest about his career. And with Lauda, the thing that he always says is he wasn't as good at playing the team game. And, you know, Lauda understood how to get a team around him and working for him. And I think, you know, Watty never really had that ability. But in terms of actual pace and racecraft.
Oh, fantastic. Wheel-to-wheel driver.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, famous for his overtaking, for his, you know, later exploits in McLarens. But he was desperately unlucky in 77 not to get a win. And I always think of Silverstone as well as that French Grand Prix because of leading James Hunt, two Brits at the front of a British Grand Prix at a time when that was actually not something that was happening anymore. So it's quite a big deal, I think. So, yeah, absolutely deserving of a good place on the list. And I think you've probably got him in the right place.
Coming on to number 8, and we're actually going to do 8 and 7 together because they tie together quite nicely. But at number 8, Kev has got Jochen Rindt, F1's posthumous world champion, very tragically in 1970. He drove for Brabham for a single season in 1968. Started 12 races, didn't take any wins, but did get two pole positions. And then at number 6, another driver who spent just a year at Brabham, it's Jackie Ickx, 1969. He raced there, started 11 races, winning twice and taking two pole positions. So, Kev, why Rindt at number 8, why Ickx at number 7, and why are we talking about the two together?
Well, I really, really wanted to put Rindt ahead because I think he was more of a Brabham driver than Ickx was. I think he was taking, you know, really, he kind of really got on well with Jack Brabham, and Jack wanted him back. So, basically, Rindt was there in 68, Ickx was there in 69. The thing that separates them really is that Rindt had to put up with the 4-cam 860 Repco engine, which could not hold together. So he had a couple of poles and was invariably quick, but he could hardly finish any races. Whereas Brabham finally gave up on that Adacolsworth DFE the following year and Ickx won two races. So I don't think Ickx was kind of, you know, he then went off to Ferrari. I don't think he was kind of in the bosom of the team in the way that Rindt had been. And Jack Brabham tried to get him get him back for 1917. Got quite close, actually. In the end, I think Colin Chapman basically just threw money at him because he didn't like the way that Jack Brabham went about his business. He felt safer there. And it was all kind of that, you know, do you want to survive or do you want to be world champion? Which sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it?
That's the famous Bernie quote, isn't it? You know, if you want to become world champion, go to Lotus. If you want to survive, stay at Brabham. It's a very Bernie kind of thing to say, but yeah, he kind of maybe had a point.
Yeah, sadly he did on this occasion, didn't he? But yeah, so I thought these two had to be together. I really wanted to put Rint ahead, but I think on the basis that he didn't win a world championship race there and he didn't go back for 1970, Ickx won two races, and one of those was a mega race as well, beating Jackie Stewart at the Nürburgring, which is pretty cool. That's why he edged ahead, really.
May I be awkward at this point? Because
of course, you're the guest. You can do what you like.
Well, so Kev, when you originally came up with this list, you sent it to me on an email just as a what do you think? And Rint wasn't on your original list. And I said, what about Jochen Rindt? And now I'm going to say to you, I don't think Jochen Rindt should be on this list. So, yeah. So basically, I did it on purpose. No, I thought about it after I sent back the email saying to you, what about Jochen Rindt? I thought, actually, in terms of we're looking at achievements and impact in a Brabham, Rindt was just very unlucky, typical thing of being in the right team at the wrong time, which we've seen many times over the years and we still see it today. He was, as you said, Kev, he was, you know, the Repco engine they had that year compared to the engine that dominated through 66 and 67, taking two world titles. It all went wrong for them in 68, and what should have been his breakthrough, you know, a big season for him, turned into a very disappointing one. So in terms of results, even though he got on very well with Jack and Jack wanted him back, I would argue he's probably outside the top 10, and I would put in Riccardo Patrese simply because longevity. He was there also at a very important time in Brabham's 80s history, and he did win races for them, albeit luckily.
I mean, that's all fair, and Patrese, I guess, is the obvious omission from the list. The reason he's not there is I had in my mind, because I did a piece earlier in the year on best number twos in F1 history, which obviously Patrese would, I mean, you know, what's the number two? Depends on your teammates are, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think he didn't pull his weight enough alongside Piquet. He wasn't driving the team, whereas Rindt was the number one. Like Jack Brabham, who was at that point a three-time world champion, was happy to step back and really admit that this guy was better than him or faster than him. Whereas I don't think there was any question, you know, during the Bernie Gordon Murray era that Ricciardo was going to be leading the team. And in fact, I think there was a bit of tension there. He left the first time round, didn't he, and then came back. So
yeah.
Perhaps you could say it's circumstances in that Patrese was never going to have a fair crack at it, given what Murray and Piquet were building together anyway. But in the end, I just felt like he didn't really do enough while he was there. Longevity almost works against him in that regard. He just never really came together for him. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I can see why it could grate that he's not in the 10.
Yeah, I'm slightly biased. I think given my age, I'm in my late 40s, and so I grew up in the 80s. And when I think of Brabham, I think of Parmalat Brabhams. First, I think of PK, and then I kind of think of Patrese, just because that was Brabham for such a decent chunk of that formative years of my youth, I suppose. I take your point that Rindt was a leader and Patrese absolutely wasn't. And I also think that Patrese was much better in a Williams than he ever was in a Brabham.
That's what I was going to say. Patrese comes to my mind. I mean, actually, he was number one in our arrows list.
Yeah.
but he actually, if I'm thinking about it, he immediately cut his boots in, and Patrese in a Williams is kind of what I think of.
Yeah, and his career kind of turned around when he got into Williams. So, but I mean, yeah, I would still maybe argue with you on that one. But you're the boss. You're the chief. Indeed.
No, that's not how these work.
Well, what I would say is that, as Kev pointed out, I think Patrese's not doing too badly on terms of the list having topped the arrows list. So maybe that's a nice fair way of...
He's a fine number 11, anyway.
Yes. Actually, I've got a feeling he was number 11 in the Williams list now.
Ah, maybe he's not doing so badly.
Okay, we have to mark check Series 1. He was on the bubble for Williams. I can't remember whether he made it in or not. I have to go and check that.
Indeed. Well, let's move on to number 6 on the Brabham top 10 drivers. We've spoken about him a little bit earlier. It's Niki Lauda. Drove for Brabham between 1978 and 1979. Started 29 races, won twice, won pole position. Kev, why is Lauda at number 6?
Well, I mean, so this is a good point to just remind everyone that this isn't a list of the greatest drivers who have sat in whatever team we're talking about, because obviously, you know, Niki Lauda is one of the all-time great drivers, three-time world champion, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's based on what they did at the team. And for me, it was quite a solid sixth place, really, because I think the top five kind of pick themselves, not necessarily in the order that, you know, you go for. But he didn't quite get the job done, but he did sort of lead the team, but he didn't completely thrash Watson, who's sort of quite, you know, just inside the 10. He scored a couple of wins. And let's remember, he did walk out on the team in the mid-season as well. I was like, oh, I'm just bored going around in circles. And also, he had a very young, quick teammate at that point that probably, you know, might not have helped the motivation.
I was going to say, do you think that Piquet was the clinching factor why he left?
I don't think it was a clinching factor, but I suspect it was a subconscious one. I think Lauda's the sort of person that literally just thought, I've had enough of this. Because in his, I can't remember if it's in his autobiography or in Alan Henry's Brabham book, where Lauda basically says that I've got this fantastic new Gordon Murray car, because they just brought out the BT49, which obviously went on to be one of the great Brabhams. If we were doing a top 10 Brabham F1 cars, that'd probably be, you know, in the top three, wouldn't it? And he just thought, I just don't really care anymore. And so, in typical Lauda fashion, got, and apparently Bernie didn't even argue with him, did he? He just went, yeah, okay, fine.
Well, he's right, isn't he? I mean, I think once a driver decides to go, he should go, Mr. Vettel. Great. You can see that time and again. I think hanging on is always the worst thing you can do. So he was right to tell Lauda to get out.
Yeah.
And Lauda went off to start his airline, didn't he?
Yeah.
Flew straight to California to order his first plane.
I mean, there were some great Brabham moments for Lauda. I mean, I guess everyone remembers Swedish Grand Prix in the fan car, but actually I think his best drive was his second place finish at Monaco when he came charging through the field. And I think he did a lap that was, I think it was one, yeah, it was nearly 2 seconds, 1.9 seconds quicker than anyone else after he'd had a puncture. And he came charging through the field to second in a, I think Nigel Roebuck described it as sort of the, you know, the best driver out around the Principality since Rins' effort in 1970 with the old Lotus 49. So there were some highlights, but I don't think it was the most convincing part of Lauda's career. And in the end, he didn't kind of get the job done in the way that the people before and after him did.
Yeah, I think Brabham didn't get the best of Niki, and I don't think really he got the best of Gordon Murray either, given the failure of the cooling car, the 46. Obviously, the fan car would have been great if it stuck around for more than one race, which must have been very frustrating for everyone involved when that car, you know, clearly it was a Lotus Beta and it was then withdrawn.
Still a very divisive car, that. I think Gordon's still adamant that it should have been allowed. And as we said on the Arrows podcast, Tony Southgate, who finished second in that race with Ricardo Pedresi, we can't not mention him, was really irritating, thinks that he was the first legitimate car, F1 car.
Yes.
So that will rage forevermore.
I interviewed Watty about that car last year and he was very entertaining. He's still quite angry at Mario Andretti because Andretti was pushing out this theory that the fan was throwing stones at the drivers behind and was a danger. And what he's convinced that's just absolute nonsense. And it was just a ruse to get it banned.
That's quite smart from Mario, though, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was very Mario Andretti, isn't it? You know. And also, you know, the other interesting thing about that car was Tyrrell was furious because he'd had a fan car himself, which they couldn't get to work. So the, you know, the 78 Tyrrell was designed originally as a fan car. And it was just the temperature was too high and they couldn't get it to work. So it was then turned back into a standard Tyrrell, which Depailler won the Monaco Grand Prix that year, but wasn't a particularly competitive car. And as Watty said, Ken did one of his froth jobs at Anderstorp and was absolutely in a rage.
I think it was probably the right decision not to have it, because you can imagine that technology develops. I mean, look how ridiculous ground effect cars got it.
Yeah.
Anyway, how stiff and awful, and short braking distances, high speed corners. It would have just been that, but multiplied by, you know, they'd have had G suits and all this kind of nonsense, and the drivers would have probably become less and less of a factor. So I think it exists much better as one of those kind of cool one-off moments rather than a path that F1 should have gone down.
Real sliding doors moment, actually. I think if it hadn't been banned, we'd have gone a completely different direction through that era.
Indeed, and almost interesting, not quite parallel, but interesting how history repeats so much. You think about F1 2022 and the suggestion from some quarters that the suggestion the porpoising was so bad it was hurting the drivers was being hammed up in an effort to get the various bits banned and get things looked at. So not suggesting that any of that is necessarily happening or what's going on.
Gamesmanship. Who would ever
always been a part of it?
Yeah. Every story has happened before. It's just different flavours and versions, isn't it?
Indeed. Well, let's move on to number five on our top 10 Brabham drivers list. At number five, it's Carlos Reutemann. Drove for Brabham between 1972 and 1976, starting 66 races, winning four times and taking two pole positions. Kev, why is Reutemann at number five?
He's not in the list because he handed Brabham the 1981 driver's title by being absolutely hopeless.
But this is probably his biggest contribution to Brabham.
It probably... So he's the first sort of number one driver during the Eccleston era. So obviously Jack Brabham retired and very quickly went, no, Ron Toranac, you have it, I'm not bothered. And then Toranac didn't really feel the same way about it without Jack. So you know, Burnley came in 72 and Reutemann was kind of the lead driver. And you know, he took pole on his world championship debut. And he led the team through the DFV era, if you like, until, as I said earlier, he lost interest with the Alpha. But you know, he won three races in 74 with the BT44. They weren't really reliable enough for him to be a championship contender, but he should have been on raw pace, I think. And then 75 was kind of the other way around. He had just the one win, but actually more consistent finishes, so he was actually higher up the table. And I know that Murray always felt that if he'd been able to just focus on developing the 44B, that Reutemann might have had a chance of winning the world championship, or at least winning the best of the rest behind, was at that point, Lauda and Ferrari were actually getting into a proper stride. That was the kind of the world championship winning car that got away, I think, from Murray's point of view. But I'm sure Reutemann would have found a way to mess it up anyway, because he was good on some days and not on others. But so he was the lead driver during quite a key moment, the start of the Murray Eccleston era, and did win some cool races. I think he's got the four wins and the two poles, which puts him up into the top five anyway. But I couldn't really force him any higher, I didn't think.
I love Reutemann. We've had this conversation before. I've always thought if you had an archetype of what a Grand Prix driver should look and act like, it's Carlos Reutemann for me. Just, you know, mean, moody, and very good looking. And as you say, blue hot and cold. I think he kind of drove Gordon Murray to distraction, but Gordon also loved him to bits as well. A great character, apparently, in the team. And he should have been better than he was, really. And I don't know, I think for the 70s, I always think of Carlos Reutemann as Brabham's kind of muse. And then the 80s, PK is, you know, so it, for me, he's definitely top five. So I wouldn't argue with you on that one.
Yeah, I think his sublime days were sublime. Like he was as good as anyone on his day. But as regular listeners and Alex will know, I kind of get infuriated by drivers that don't deliver their potential regularly enough. And he's almost the definition of that sort of driver. You know, we talked about people like Fernando Alonso before, the car's falling to pieces and he's driving it around, he finds a way to get a lap time out of it. Whereas, I think you've spoken to Patrick Head about this, Damo, that if there was something slightly off and it wasn't perfect, then Reutemann, sort of his head would drop and he would then exaggerate the problem rather than find a way of getting around it. So that's why my enthusiasm for him is still slightly limited. But from a romantic point of view, which is kind of maybe what the 70s F1 stuff should be about.
I tend to look at it from that perspective, whereas you're more analytical and probably rightly so in your position. But
my team would probably win more races, but you'd have more fans.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm also thinking that chief editor is a less romantic position than editor in chief.
Oh, I don't know. Editor in chief was a pretty cold position to be in. It was very
Look, you're opening
lofty. Stop asking lofty. Sorry. And actually, for what it's worth, I was thinking as you were saying how Reutemann is what you think a Grand Prix driver should look like. Obviously, it's different eras, it's very different styles. But I personally think I want all my Grand Prix drivers not to look identical, but Lewis Hamilton, genuinely, just the tattoos, the high fashion, being able to go on an American chat show and everyone know who you are because you're that much of a superstar.
Yeah,
that's what I think, rather than a robot dressed in team kit. Do you see what I mean?
Well, absolutely. Like, I've always thought the correlation between Lewis Hamilton today and late 60s, early 70s era Jackie Stewart, you know, with the big sideburns, and Emerson Fittipaldi with the big shades, you know, there's an absolute correlation between these guys, because, you know, Grand Prix drivers used to be Jim Clark or Brill Cream and neat haircuts, and suddenly they look like rock stars, you know, they look like the Beatles. And today, you know, Lewis looks like a rap star. There's an absolute correlation. So, but for me, the 70s, Carlos Reutemann is kind of where it's at.
I mean, the picture of him airborne at the Nürburgring and the martini Brabham does. Yeah. I mean, that is a cool.
I mean,
it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the 44 BT 44, and you know, either in plain white livery with the black pinstripes, and then with the martini livery, you can't beat that.
I always thought if only it had the red martini livery on it at some point, that might have been the greatest, or completely off-piste here, could be the greatest looking F1 car of all time with that shape, with the red and the double blue. It looks absolutely awesome.
Again, this moment does come out quite regularly on this top 10 list. It's which top 10 list are you going to write next? The top 10 best looking
I've already done the top 10 best looking F1 cars. Visit autosport.com to find, as you just put it into Google search, you'd probably find it quicker.
we have to do a podcast on it, clearly. Let's get on to the next driver in our Brabham list. And again, we're going to do number 4 and number 3 together. Now, everyone, including listeners, please bear with me when I try and utter this sentence that I've written down on my list. For number 4, it's Denny Holm. Now, he's not the first world champion on this particular list. That was Rint. He is the first Brabham world champion on this list, but not Brabham's first world champion, because he won in 1967 the world title and Jack Brabham won in 1966.
Well done, you've achieved that.
Thank you. And actually, that was
the first edit as well.
It was the first take. Usually, though, it takes me quite a few to get through these things. But anyway, Holm drove for Brabham between 1965 and 1967, started 26 races, taking 2 victories but no pole positions. And then at number 3, we're going to talk 3 and 4 together. Dan Gurney drove for Brabham between 1963 and 1965, starting 30 races, winning twice and taking 2 pole positions. So, Kev, why are Holm and Gurney your 4 and 3?
So the natural thing would be to have Holm ahead of Gurney, because Holm won a world championship in a Brabham, right? But for me, Holm's a Brabham number 2, who took his opportunity when it came along. And it was, I think you could run the 1967 100 times and Holm wins it once, because half the time, I think, Jack Brabham would win it again, and the other half, Jim Clark's lowest 49 hole to get along enough to win, because the 49 was the quicker car. But fair play to Holm, he took the championship. But he never had he didn't have a single pole. He had 2 wins all this time there. I think most of the time he was a number 2 to Brabham, whereas Gurney, Gurney was the first Brabham driver that Jack immediately went, well, he's kind of the team leader, I can take a step back. He was actually thinking of retiring during 1965. And the idea was that Gurney would be driving the Brabham Retco in 66. And I'm pretty confident to say he would have won that championship pretty comfortably, I think, because he was quicker than Jack. And Jack did win it in that car. So Gurney's a number one that left at the wrong time. He was he kind of left Brabham just as it was a championship opportunity was coming along. And Holm was sort of there in the right place at the right time. And also Gurney, I think, has to take some, you know, if we're looking at impact, he took the first win. He was he took the, I think he's unique in taking the first win for 3 different constructors in Formula One, Porsche, Brabham, and his own Eagle operation, which is pretty good because he only won 4 races, which I think does him a massive disservice. So I had to put Gurney ahead of 3. I'm a bit of a fan, I'll be honest.
I wouldn't disagree with you, but it's, I think Holm's achievement is sometimes overlooked a little bit in terms of what he managed, considering that he served a long apprenticeship in the wings in terms of Formula One, because Gurney was there and Jack was there. He got his chance, and how he took it. You know, I mean, there was a lot of luck involved in the fact that he lasted, whereas obviously the Clark and Brabham had troubled races that year, and he won it by default, maybe. But the fact is, he still won it and really came from nowhere to be world champion. I mean, if you'd said to someone 2 years before, Denny Holm will be world champion in 67, you know, no one would have taken you seriously. I think it's a significant achievement he deserves more credit, I think.
Now, that's probably fair, but I would say that if you were doing a list of the best Grand Prix driver, surprisingly, I have also started that, best Grand Prix drivers never to win the world championship, aside from the obvious number one, I think Gurney's really high. Gurney's in my 5. And I think that those 5, I think they're in a clear 5 in that group that overlap the bottom end of the F1 champions, right? So the top, is it 34 drivers have won the world? You should know this. Max Verstappen, he was the 34th, I think. I think 34 drivers have won the world championship. And I would say that that doesn't represent the best 34 drives in F1 history.
No.
And for me, Holman, Gurney are in that overlap.
I agree with you, by the way, that, you know, Gurney should be ahead, because I'm also a big admirer of Gurney as well. But Holman's an interesting one in the sense that he came through that that 60s era. He then came through slick tyres, aerodynamics, and, you know, was still racing well, you know, well into the mid-70s. By, you know, 74, he was still at McLaren. So I've got, he's got an interesting career, and he lasted a long time at the top while not being one of the premier drivers.
Yeah, you know, I think that's, you know, entirely fair. Although, so, I must admit, when I think, this maybe says more about me than Holm, but if I think Denny Holm, I immediately think Sid Taylor, Lola T, 72 white with a green stripe down it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I'm not sure I can hem that. I'm not sure I can crobe that, well, that into a list anywhere.
Well, just to confirm for the listeners, Max Verstappen was indeed the 34th.
Yes.
F1 World Champion, which of course I knew, you didn't have to look up. I didn't want to interrupt your lovely flow.
Yeah.
I think I got away with that.
I remember being at a Coy's festival in the early 90s and suddenly realising in the pit next door was Denny Holm. And he was basically sort of guest driving in a BMW tin top for that weekend. It was just really cool to see him. And it was only a matter of about a year later, I was on my way to university, my first day with my dad, and I got motoring news because it was a Wednesday, so I couldn't get Autosport. And news was that Denny had died. So I've always had a bit of a soft spot for him, I think. But, I mean, Gurney, he kind of ran out of patience with Brabham, didn't he, in terms of...
lots of engine problems.
Yeah.
Real problems with the climax.
But the interesting thing about it is, you know, Brabham was formed primarily as a production car manufacturer in Formula Junior, Formula 3, Formula 2. That's what Ron Torak was interested in, was producing lots of cars to basically be a reliable Lotus. When they were, people trusted Brabham. And yet in Formula 1, in those early days, they were deeply unreliable. They should have won a lot more than they did, which is why Gurney left. It's quite an interesting one, the paradox between the production car side of things and the Formula 1 team.
Yeah, yeah. Although, as I say, I think they had a lot of problems with Climax, didn't they, during the 1500cc, which I wonder if that actually then contributed to Jack's thinking about the Repcos. I need a reliable, because I think he must have known that everyone was going to be in a shambles for the 3 litre.
Yeah.
So he just got himself a sensible, very pragmatic approach to it all, really.
Yeah, Jack never won a World Championship Grand Prix in the 1.5 litre era.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we're already at our final two, which is another pairing we're going to introduce together. The first is Nelson Piquet, who, of course, has been in the headlines for all the wrong reasons of late, which, to be clear, that all came to light after Kev had set these positions. And in any case, Piquet does remain rather a central figure to the Brabham story, regardless of how unpleasant that and other episodes involving him were. But Nelson Piquet is number two, and at number one, Jack Brabham founded his eponymous team, took its first world title, 1966, as I said earlier. And of course, he remains the only person to win a world title in a car bearing their own name. Just to run through the stats of these two, Piquet drove for Brabham between 1978 and 1985, started 106 races, won 13 times, took 18 poles. Whereas Jack Brabham drove for his squad between 1962 and 1970, started 80 races, won 7 times, took 8 poles. Now, Kev, that's your one and two. Was it as easy as putting Brabham as number one, bearing in mind what he created and what he achieved?
No, because this is actually one of the closest number ones. So we've said before that actually the number one quite often picks themselves. It's surprising how often there's been a clear number one on these lists. But this one I did hum and haw about quite a bit, because on every sort of objective metric, PK is ahead. So he started more races, he took more wins, he took more poles. He holds the Brabham record for all those stats. He's the only Brabham driver to have won 2 world titles there. And I think if you were going purely on on-track performance, you would say that Piquet would be ahead. You'd probably put Piquet ahead of Brabham on pure driving. But ultimately, I just couldn't see, like, we try and factor in impact. And it's always a balance of, well, how much impact do you need to overcome the on-track stuff? Well, I'd say being the founder of the team and winning the world championship in your own car, I mean, it doesn't get much more impactful than that. And that's the difference between him and Bruce McLaren, in that Bruce didn't really get the job done in his own car, and actually McLaren didn't go on to be super successful until after his death at Goodwood. Whereas Jack Brabham was a driving force, did win the world championship, you know, won the driver's title, won the constructor's title. They won it again the next year. Obviously, Denny Hulme was driver's champion, and that was all driven by Jack. A lot of it was driven by Jack. And he showed that he still had it in his last season, you know, the BT 33 in 1970. He was pretty unlucky not to win more races that year against the, you know, the Wonder car, Lotus 72, that would go on for another 5 years. So both of them are two of the greats of the sport. And, you know, PK was the guy during the Gordon Murray, Bernie Eccleston era. So it could have put him number one, but I just couldn't see past the founder of the company. But I don't know if Damien will agree or not.
I'm really torn. I'm really torn on this one. I'm like you. And I probably would nudge towards Jack because of that achievement in 66 of, you know, finding a left field power source the way that he did, which came out of nowhere and undercut everyone. You know, I always think, you know, the international trophy that year, Surtees realised we're in trouble when he got, you know, Jack came out and beat him in the non-championship race. And to do it at 40 as well, I think, was pretty special. I mean, you know, people called him the old man, and he famously donned a beard and a walking stick on the grid at Zandvoort.
Zandvoort, 66.
Yeah.
Wish he then went and won.
Yeah, exactly. You know, on that amazing summer that he had. What an achievement, you know. And it's also interesting how much, you know, he loved driving, you know. And that's what it's interesting, that as soon as he stopped driving, he walked away from Formula One. He didn't stick around to be a team boss, which you know, he could have done, you know. He was all about the driving, really, Jack, wasn't he? And he loved being in Formula One, and he was kind of torn to leave.
Well, he was reluctant to go even when he did, didn't he?
He didn't want to go. No, he could have raced on, yeah, actually. A little bit like, you know, Alonso today is, what, 41 this year? So, you know, Jack raced on till 44, and that was in 1970. So, okay, you know, aerodynamic forces and stuff are much bigger these days. You could say the sport is a lot more competitive. It actually is a lot more competitive today than it was then. But that was still quite remarkable then. So yeah, I think you're probably right, Kev. But I've got a soft spot for PK as well. Just you know, putting aside everything that's happened recently, forget about that. In terms of the period we're talking about, PK was a little bit special as well.
Yeah, and I think PK was probably closer to the best driver of his era than Jack was.
I think that's true.
That Jack had moments where he was happy. You could say this is a strength as a team manager, but he had moments where he was, yeah, with, first of all, with Gurney, then with Rint, and then with Ickx, where he was kind of happy to step back and go, okay, you're the young hard charger, you're quicker than me, you go off and I'll focus on... If you read his autobiography, actually, he talks about the racing and the driving the least of almost any driver. It's all about the behind-the-scenes stuff and the getting it together, and you know, he had a feeling going to 66 that he had something, and Dan went, so he went, well, I'm going to drive it then because I reckon I've got... And I think he's one of those drivers that drove better when the car was better. I don't think he was going to be a heroic hauling an uncompetitive car around.
Yeah.
And to sort of on PK's another, you know, strength of PK, let's remember how important, integral he was to the BMW turbo program, because Brabham and BMW nearly fell out a couple of occasions because the car kept, you know, blowing up, and PK was the one that, you know, kept it together, went and did a lot of the testing, did a lot of the hard graft behind the scenes, basically effectively sacrificed the 82 world title, which he probably could have won in a DFV BT49, given that Ross Bird did in the Williams.
Yeah, that's true.
To go into the okay, so they needed a little bit of needed a little bit of Renault messing up in 83 to get the opportunity.
Well, he shouldn't have won in 83, should he? He shouldn't have won the title.
He shouldn't really. But it was kind of, you know, it was kind of a payback for all his hard work.
Well, he's the archetype for me of the driver who puts in the hard work to race easier. You know, despite the public perception of what PK is, he was a real grafter, and everyone who worked with him had a lot of time for him from that perspective. I think he got through a lot of engineers during his I mean, certainly I was talking to Pat Simmons about his time at Benetton, you know, and he was, you know, Pat Simmons clearly doesn't have a great lot of time for Nelson Piquet, given what happened many years later with his son. But he was surprised by Piquet's work ethic at Benetton and how much he put in to that team. And certainly he was younger. He certainly did at Brabham as well.
Yeah, I mean, you don't win three world championships by...
You're not a lucky three-time world champion.
No, I mean, I think that he probably had more of the slice of luck for those three than some other three-time world champions, particularly 87, which is not part of this remit because obviously he went off to Williams by then. And of course he did, if you remember, even after Brabham sort of fell away, you know, they went on to Pirelli tyres and they got overtaken in terms of race day pace by McLaren tag, you know, Porsche engines. Yeah, he was still a qualifying, like with the wick turned up in the turbo era, Piquet was still something else. Mm. Was he timed at 176 miles an hour at the end of the straight at Brands Hatch? Anyone that's been to Brands Hatch, anything doing 176 miles an hour at the end of the start-finish straight, straight in inverted commas, that's pretty awesome.
There's the ridiculous testing lap at Goodwood as well, isn't there?
Yeah, the alleged, what was it? Was it an alleged 61 or something?
Something like that. Well, it may have been even sub-minute.
They never, because there's never been sort of official confirmation, but the average speed around there must have been. Actually, that's something that he shares with Holm. Because didn't Holm give Simon Taylor a passenger ride in the Can-Am McLaren and went round Goodwood quicker than the then lap record in the Can-Am McLaren?
Yeah,
that must have been quite a passenger ride, crikey.
Yeah, I think Piquet, the racing driver for me, is special, and great helmet design as well, which counts for a lot in my book.
But he's number two.
The team. I think you're probably right, Kev, to put Jack at number one, given the achievements he managed, particularly that late in his career, and he had a massive testing shunt at Silverstone in '69, and his account of that is really incredible. How he was trapped in the car with a broken leg, I think it is, and he, and the team finally came round to him to free him. And Ron Dennis was actually marshalling the mechanics to free the boss from the car, and that left Ickx to sort of lead the team through the summer. But Jack came back from that.
Yeah, and actually, that's during a time when they literally did go test it with no marshals or whatever.
Yeah.
So if you did go off, you basically had to rely on your team going, oh, I can't hear the engine anymore.
No, exactly.
Jump in the car and go around and see if he's all right.
That's exactly it.
Absolutely crazy.
And then to come back the way he did in 70, if he hadn't binned it at Gasworks at Monaco in front of Rindt, if he hadn't run out of fuel at Brands, that would have changed the whole dynamic of that season.
Yeah, well, also they had a fuel system problem that they didn't spot for two or three races. Again, he talks about this in his autobiography. I think it's when the flag falls or when the flag drops. I think it's a really interesting book, and he's kind of kicks himself that they didn't get hold of this fuel issue, which made him uncompetitive for three or four races. Because then at the end of the year, he's actually running third at the season finale, which is the first of the DFV runners after the Ferraris, which were kind of coming on strong then, when his engine failed. So he was running third at the age of 44 in his last Grand Prix. It's pretty cool.
And one of my proudest things at Autosport, during my time at Autosport, was getting Jack over for the awards one year. And he was given, a Gregor Grant Award. And I was involved in basically convincing Jack and Margaret, his wife, to come over from Australia, and was sort of on the phone to Margaret quite regularly through November, sort of making sure the flights were organised and they were happy with the hotel arrangements. And when he came off stage, he came over and shook my hand, which was just, I was a bit starstruck and didn't really have much to say to him, but it was lovely to meet him and to welcome him to the awards that year. It was very special.
A very nice note on which to end our podcast. So, Kev, thank you very much. Damo, thank you. And obviously, thanks to everybody listening along. Do let us know what you thought.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
For this episode, send us an email, hit us up on social media. But we'll be back soon with a new episode of the Autosport Podcast.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
The is it morning yet deal. How about now? Or now? Because morning time is McDonald's breakfast time. And that's the best time of all the times.
Wake up with a little splash of sweetness. Get any size iced coffee from caramel to hazelnut to French vanilla for just 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Sports Social Podcast Network.